Local News, Culture, and NPR.
From WJFF, this is a special edition.
From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, I'm Tim Bruno. This is Radio Chatskill. On today's show, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro has unveiled his 2025 budget priorities. The governor's asking the Pennsylvania legislature to legalize recreational cannabis, tax popular gaming terminals, and direct more than $500 million to the state's poorest schools. We'll get the details from Spotlight PA. Candles, cooking, and caution fire safety tips to keep your Valentine's Day safe from the National Fire Protection Association. Did you hear about that city-killing asteroid that might hit Earth? Thankfully, our resident science guy, Joe Johnson, did, and he's here to tell us about that and other science stories that caught his eye, and culture reporter Valerie Manzi with an intimate classical music salon this Saturday. First, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. American teacher Mark Fogel has been released from a Russian prison and has returned to the U.S. He was detained in 2021 for carrying medical marijuana. President Trump welcomed Fogel to the White House yesterday. Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, helped secure Fogel's release.
Mark languished there for 3.5 years, and he shouldn't have. He should have been out, you know, before. But he's out now. His family is grateful. He is as happy a human being as you're going to find, as the country will find out. Mm-hmm. And he's extraordinarily grateful to the president, our president, President Trump, and also to President Putin.
He spoke to CNN. Russia says that in exchange, the U.S. has released a Russian citizen who has been imprisoned in the U.S. It is not known publicly who that person is. The Trump administration is slashing the budget of the General Services Administration in half. Those cuts could affect nearly all federal properties and contracts. NPR's Jenna McLaughlin reports that's according to sources who spoke to NPR on condition of anonymity, fearing further retribution from the Trump administration.
The General Services Administration manages federal real estate across the country, as well as nearly all federal contracts. Without it, federal agencies would have a lot of trouble buying things and providing essential public services. However, GSA employees have been told their budget is being cut by 50%, spread across contracts, leases, and personnel salaries. Employees who remain and who don't take a deferred resignation offer will be subject to heightened surveillance, including installation of what's called a keylogger, software that tracks everything the user types. It could be the model for the rest of the federal government going forward. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
Stocks opened sharply lower this morning as the Labor Department reported higher than expected inflation last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled more than 380 points in early trading.
Forecasters had expected to see some moderation in price hikes last month, but inflation remains stubbornly high. Consumer prices in January were up 3% from a year ago. Prices rose by 0.5% between December and January alone. Egg prices jumped more than 15% last month after avian flu forced egg farmers to cull millions of laying hens in December. Overall, grocery prices were up by 0.5%. Stripping out food and energy prices, which bounce around a lot, core inflation was also higher than forecasters had expected. Given the sticky price hikes, the Federal Reserve is expected to take its time before making any additional cuts to interest rates. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is threatening to resume hostilities in Gaza if Hamas does not release 3 hostages by Saturday. That's supposed to be in accordance with the ceasefire. This week, Hamas had said it was delaying the hostages' release and then blamed Israel for violating the ceasefire. It's NPR. The White House has fired the inspector general of the agency USAID. That happened one day after Inspector General Paul Martin's office released a critical report on President Trump's work to dismantle the agency. The report says this makes it pretty much impossible for the agency to monitor more than $8 billion in unspent humanitarian aid. That means the aid could fall into the wrong hands. Most countries have missed a key United Nations deadline to submit plans to fight climate change. NPR's Julia Simon reports only a few countries made it on time.
As part of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, nearly 200 countries agreed to submit targets for reducing their climate pollution by 2035. The hope is that all these cuts combined will limit the world's warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. Earlier this week was the deadline for countries to submit these targets. Only a dozen countries met the deadline. One of those countries was the U.S. The U.S. submitted a climate target right before Biden left office. Trump then pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement. The hard deadline is in September. Climate experts say they'll be especially looking to see how ambitious China and the European Union are with their cuts to climate pollution. Julia Simon, NPR News.
Forecasters say another winter storm is going to pummel much of the U.S. The National Weather Service says heavy snow will fall from the Central Plains into the Great Lakes and New England by Friday. In the south, the danger is from thunderstorms and heavy rain. Forecasters say there's a risk of hail and even tornadoes across much of the southeast. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Governor Josh Shapiro is asking the Pennsylvania legislature to legalize recreational cannabis, tax popular gaming terminals, and direct more than $500 million to the state's poorest schools as part of his $51.4 billion budget plan. The governor's latest budget pitch, which he unveiled last week, would also send an additional $290 million to the state's public transit agencies, invest more in a new student teacher stipend, and set a base tuition rate for cyber charter schools. In his hour and a half long address, Shapiro also threw his support for the first time behind bipartisan proposals to expunge certain eviction records and increase state oversight of private equity acquisitions of hospitals and nursing homes. His full budget proposal also includes a sweeping energy plan that targets emissions while offering industry tax credits. Jason Dole spoke to Spotlight PA's Stephen Caruso to learn more.
This is a budget that I feel like we've seen before here in Pennsylvania. The proposal for legalizing marijuana to try and get revenues from that to buoy the state's bottom line, he proposed that last year. That's proposed by Democratic governors since 2019. Skill games is an issue that's been a ulcer for the General Assembly since like the mid-2010s. That just due to the warring nature of the lobbies at play, we're talking about casinos, horse racing, the skill game manufacturers and producers and those who keep them themselves, that it hasn't been done. And that's potentially another couple hundred million dollars. Shapiro is proposing putting about $500 million to the poorest schools in Pennsylvania. That's needed because of a state court ruling in 2023 that said the state was unconstitutionally underfunding poor districts. But, you know, and that's a number that's pretty small if you're a public education advocate who saw that ruling as validation that the state needs to step up its game. And, you know, honestly, it's a boring, humdrum, but also important thing. One of the biggest sources of new spending in this $51 billion budget is more money for Medicaid. Pennsylvania's Medicaid user base has expanded greatly. They're sicker than expected. It's just costing more money. And because of that, the state's going to put a lot of new dollars into making sure that folks who need that care can get it, and that's going to be a big part of the budget. So in some ways, what's remarkable about this budget is how I would say there's not many like very remarkable pieces. We've seen most of these items before.
I was wondering if you could put that observation into any kind of political context for what's going on in Pennsylvania. Is there any significance one way or the other that you're seeing many things that you've seen before?
Well, I think that within the budget, you know, it's a boring one, but I thought the governor in his address point, like he brought up some interesting issues that, as he put it, I think he even used the phrase are like, you know, cost free, because there are issues that where the General Assembly can pass laws that might not cost state dollars. For instance, He specifically talked a lot about health care. He called for the state to put ACA protections, such as the ban on pre-existing condition discrimination from insurers, into state law in case the ACA goes away under the second Trump administration. He also called for a big swing against private equity, who he I believe he called vultures trying to gobble up health care systems. He thought that there should be more review of their acquisition of private health care systems, profit or nonprofit, and also there should be ban on a specific agreements where basically the private equity company, after acquiring, say, a hospital, sells the land that the hospital is on to another shell company that might be owned by the very same investors and starts, like, renting, making the hospital pay rent on it. It basically is a way to suck profits and revenues out of a healthcare provider. And we've seen this happen with nursing homes and other places when private equity buys up. So Shapiro put himself out there, I would say, especially on the healthcare stuff. I mean, you know, that's I think, a very populist rhetoric. But that stuff has had bipartisan support, too. You know, there's been a lot of non-ideological, or I should say non-partisan outrage about how people get healthcare in this country. And Shapiro did try to put himself into that debate. So that, I think, what I'm struck by is it seems like he's trying to hold the line on spending in some ways to get Republican support, but he is trying to stick himself out there on other issues where he thinks there's more bipartisan support, such as healthcare.
Now, you mentioned education and you mentioned that court ruling. Can you just give us a little bit more detail about that? Explain what the adequacy gap is and just why is this issue so critical and what this proposed funding for schools might mean?
Yeah, so adequacy is kind of like the concept of, you know, every single student needs a set amount of money. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I want to say it's in the $11,000 to $12,000 range every year to meet all of their needs. Or, like, you know, we're talking, get them textbooks, make sure the teacher is paid for the time that they put to the kid, you know, make sure that the school is heated enough for them, or cool enough for them. And then adequacy is kind of the idea that there are a lot of school districts that do not have that same level of funding per student to be able to meet their needs. And then that number per student can go up if we're talking about kids who come from low-income backgrounds, if they're coming from a household where English isn't the first language, things like that. And so the adequacy gap has just been trying to put this number on, like, how much of a shortfall is there for many poor districts. And this is not just urban. This is rural districts. Like I said, it can be districts with poor kids, kids who don't speak English, et cetera, et cetera. What is that number? And it varies district by district, but the number to get every school up to adequacy was put in, I want to believe, I think it was about the $8-9 billion range after the ruling came out. You know, many billions of dollars. And the state so far has put many billions of dollars more. I think we're at about $1 billion going directly to schools. And then you could add hundreds of millions of dollars more for things like school breakfast, more funding for mental health, other, like, you know, wraparound programs, a school construction to help old schools be renovated. But, like, you know, so it's a big number that the state has put in through bipartisan compromise in the last couple of years. But if you're an education advocate, you just look at all the money that's still not there. And education is this issue that compounds. You know, it's like if you're a kid who's in a underfunded school in third grade, you know, every year that ticks by where you're dealing with incomplete funding is another year where you're not getting the right level of education, an unconstitutional level of education even. So that's been what's driving our education funding debate.
The issue of funding is a debate. There's a lot of debate over whether the state can afford this budget. Republicans are warning of deficits. Democrats are saying this is necessary spending. How valid are the concerns of people warning of deficits? How does Shapiro justify the spending increases?
Pennsylvania's budget is basically being balanced on just stored up one-time revenues from the pandemic, higher than expected tax returns, federal dollars that came in, extra federal aid. And we consistently, as a commonwealth, have not had as much revenue come in through taxes as was then spent, even on the needs that are many for, you know, people who need health care, for public transit, for education. Though the tax revenue coming in has not matched the required spending that's gone out. So, you know, to then add more spending that needs to be repeated year after year after year and compounds, the state's going to need more money. And marijuana and skill games, as the governor proposed, are, you know, around the edges, you know, there are a couple hundred million dollars, but like, you know, when we're talking about billions, we're talking about the state needs billions of new dollars in revenue. No one is bringing up the dreaded T word of taxes, but I think that, you know, when you look at Senate Republicans, that's what they raise the threat of that. No Democrat, Shapiro or House Democrats, have brought up the point of taxes, but Senate Republicans are pointing out, like, we're probably going to need that. Then Democrats usually counter, well, if you don't want to raise taxes, what are you going to cut? Because the fact of the matter is, we really can't afford to keep spending as much money as we are unless we find new revenue in the Commonwealth.
Now, and as you just mentioned there, there are these proposals for legalizing recreational marijuana. As you said, that's been on the docket before. This is something that's been talked about for the last 6 years. Is anything different on the ground politically on this issue this time around?
I think it's still kind of early to say. I mean, my colleague Kate Huangpu has been doing some really good reporting. You know, she tracked down every member of, like, you know, the Senate committee that would be in charge of this and found that, you know, there were, I think, like two Democrats who were willing to say, yeah, sure, two Republicans who offered their concerns. Everyone else just didn't really want to talk about it. I think this is an issue that Pennsylvania is really slow to act. And I've, you know, some people say that's by design. In any legislative representative democracy, Pennsylvania also has some special things that make it, I think, particularly slow. But with that said, the governor called for it. He said he's going to have specific legislation. That was a critique that Senate Republicans brought up, as they thought that the governor oftentimes would ask for things without going into specifics, which they said would make it harder to cut a deal. I think House Democrats still aren't on the same page as to whether they want to sell it through state stores as Pennsylvania sells liquor, or if they want to allow the private market that already exists here for medical marijuana to swoop in and be able to get access to it. And also, there's going to be a lot of push from grassroots advocates and small businessmen who want to get a piece of this market as well and not just leave it open to the big multi-state operators that have increasingly dominated marijuana. You know, just like skill games, there's a lot of cross forces kind of operating against each other that don't neatly map onto Republican, Democrat, or, you know, just legislative executive. And I think that's why this is a tough debate. You know, obviously polling does well. Many states have legalized it. But all of these factors are why it's so slow for something like Pennsylvania, particularly when, you know, you have a split legislature, to get moving in one direction.
You know, over here on my side of the river, which is New York State, a lot of the budgeting process and a lot of the visible end of the legislative session so far has been about the state preparing for and or reacting to a new Trump administration in Washington. I'm wondering, is any of that national politics playing out in the Pennsylvania legislative process, especially the rollout of this budget? Is there any kind of, on the surface, demonstrable reactions or preparations for this new administration going on in this budgeting process?
On the surface, no. I think you see undercurrents of it, though. For instance, you know, to address the elephant in the room of, like, the proposed federal funding freeze proposed by President Trump, I mean, that would just knock the knees out from, I think, almost any municipal or state budget in the country at this point. I mean, Pennsylvania, the revenue we're talking about, $51 billion budget here funded by state tax revenues for the most part, as we mentioned, and federal dollars pay for $53 billion. So, like, if those are even significantly reduced, it's almost like in some ways, it's almost like unfair for the state to come up with a way to fill that gap. You know, it's like how, like, when we are not even able to maybe fill $51 billion in spending, you know, all of a sudden having this huge opening of all the federal dollars would be huge. So in some ways, it's almost like a conversation you don't want to have until you absolutely have to have it. But with that said, too, I mean, Senate Republicans were asked about this. Do they have concerns? And our Majority Leader Joe Pittman said he felt pretty sure that just once the Trump economy took root, that this would solve itself. You know, that would just lead to higher tax returns and everything would be fine. You know, the governor has, you know, noted that large amount of money that comes from the feds. He hasn't pointed out to too many things that he thought were directly coming because of what the Trump administration could do. But he also, I think, did try to cut a bipartisan tone in his budget address, that, you know, if you want to cheer for President Trump, you can at one point. You know, he's, I think, notably always tried to, like, cut this tact of appearing on cable news to attack Trump, but also in his public remarks as governor, try to be a uniter. And, you know, legislative Democrats, though, they were definitely a little more upfront that, like, look, this could have big potential consequences. It's hard to predict what's happening up there. I think everybody's in wait and see. And because we do have a divided legislature, divided government, and this is a state that has voted for both Joe Biden and Donald Trump in the past three elections, you don't. This is a state where, you know, you can't necessarily go against Trump on everything, but also if you went with him on everything, you'd probably elicit a lot of outrage as well. And I think everyone's just trying to bide their time and see when they really have to make a stand instead of just, you know, throwing out a few words now and then.
As we wrap up here, I was wondering if you could just give us an idea of what the time frame and the steps are ahead in terms of Governor Shapiro trying to get this budget passed. What are the next steps? What are the challenges he faces, and what will you be watching?
Well, you know, budget hearings start next week. That'll be secretaries and policymakers from the administration will go sit in front of a panel of legislators and answer all the best questions that those legislators have. That'll kind of frame debates. People will bring up the things that they like, they don't like. We'll get a better sense of maybe some sticking points from there. Debates will move behind closed doors. It'll be just among some of the top policymakers in both the House Democrats, Senate Republicans, and Governor Josh Shapiro. That will all then crescendo through to the June 30th budget deadline. It could go later than that, though. We've had two late budgets. 2023 was a real impasse. 2024 was just, they took another week or two to, fine print the details. So with that said, divided legislature is always hard. I also do think, you know, Josh Shapiro was in the veep stakes last year for a while. His political ambitions for the national stage are well known. Everyone has an opinion on them in the halls of the Capitol. And I think because of that, you do have to just layer the, everyone's going to be doing some calculus of like, okay, but like, do we want to give him a win, or what wins are we comfortable giving him? That's going to be happening just as much as any sort of policy debates over what's the right or wrong way to balance the budget.
Stephen Caruso is a Capitol reporter for Spotlight PA. You can see his work and the work of his colleagues up now at spotlightpa.org. We've been talking about the budget process in Pennsylvania, and it's been phenomenal. Stephen, thank you so much for going over all this with us.
Not a problem at all. Happy the yap.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, some safety tips for Valentine's Day. Fire safety tips, that is. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union, and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As Valentine's Day approaches, you may be planning a romantic dinner at home, complete with candles and a home-cooked meal. However, the National Fire Protection Association is urging folks to keep fire safety in mind while celebrating this holiday of love. Susan McKelvey is from the National Fire Protection Association, and she joins us now. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning.
Now, Valentine's Day, I kind of think of chocolate and flowers. Why is fire safety such a key concern during these Valentine's Day celebrations?
So we know that people a lot of times are celebrating Valentine's Day at home. And with that, that often means cooking a special meal, lighting candles to, you know, create a warm glow to your home. And all those things are great, and we want people to be doing all of that. We just want to make sure that they're doing it with fire safety in mind, because we know that cooking is by far the leading cause of home fires, and candles are also a significant cause of home fires in the U.S. So we just want to make sure that when people are celebrating the holiday, they're doing it safely.
So what are some of the most common causes of fires during the holiday, especially when it comes to cooking and candles?
So cooking big one because we know that the leading cause of cooking fires is unattended cooking. And when you're trying to do a lot of things at once, and you're probably trying to get yourself together, you're getting your dinner together, you're making your home look nice, you might want to clean up. So it's easy to get distracted. So we want to make sure that people make plans so that when they are cooking that they can keep a close eye on things. And you also just want to make sure that you're clearing the area of clutter, anything that can burn, you know, things like food packaging, paper towels, dish towels, oven mitts, anything that can burn, keep it well away from the cooking area. Some simple tips like that can really go a long way to ensure that you're cooking without incurring the likelihood of a fire.
Let's talk about some specific safety tips when it comes to cooking. It's, you know, I think people may think they know what to do, but it's always important to remind folks again, especially when cooking, it's important to have a lid nearby. How can that help in the case of a grease fire, for instance?
Right. So a majority of cooking fires occur on the stovetop when they involve frying or oil cooking. So if you have a small grease pan fire or any kind of, you know, pan fire, if you have a lid nearby, you can, if you carefully slide it over the pan and immediately turn off the heat source, you can effectively smother the flames. And you just want to make sure that the pan cools completely before carefully checking to see that it's out. So that can be very effective. We do encourage you that at NFPA, our priority is people's safety. So if you have any concerns, call the fire department, get outside, and make sure everyone is safe. But again, something like having a lid nearby can be very effective. Same thing actually goes for if you have, you know, maybe you're broiling something, and if there's an oven fire, you want to close the, make sure that the oven door is closed, turn off the heat source, wait for the oven to cool completely before reopening it. But again, when in doubt, contact the fire department and stay safe, because we want to ensure that people are safe more than anything else.
Don't use a towel or an oven mitt, because that could catch fire.
Exactly. Exactly. So you really want to keep anything that can burn well away from those areas.
And NFPA also encourages creating a kid and pet free zone around the stove while you're cooking. Why is that important, and how can families try to implement that?
So, you know, obviously we want to ensure that children and pets aren't near areas where there's heat being generated or that things can you know, spill and cause burns. So one of the things that we do encourage people to do is when you're cooking, you've got pans and pots on the stove, push the handles inward so that they can't be knocked over easily. But the best thing to do for children and pets, like you said, is create a 3-foot safety zone around the cooking area so that everyone knows that they can't come within that area, and that ensures that they won't come in contact with something that's hot. For really young children, sometimes you can even take, you know, like some sort of tape or visual so that kids can actually see the area that they need to stay out of while you're cooking.
Let's talk about those candles. Why is it recommended not to burn a candle all the way down? How can that be a potential hazard?
So the flames can grow larger when there is no wick or wax left. So you really just want to make sure that you're not burning them all the way down to the bottom. But like with cooking, leaving candles unattended is where a real risk happens. So you want to make sure that when you are using real candles, that you're keeping a close eye on them. You don't want to leave the room when they're on, or obviously leave your home. You don't want to go to bed while you've got candles burning. Simple things like that can really go a long way to ensuring that you're using them safely. The other thing you do want to do with candles is make sure that they're at least a foot away from anything that can burn. Lots of times people will put decorations around candles or put them near combustibles, and that presents a risk. So when you're using candles, you have to remember it's an open flame in your home, and you have to use them with caution.
Now, a lot of folks use candles in their bedrooms or bathrooms. What are specific risks associated with those areas, and why should folks keep candles out of those rooms?
Yeah, you never want to have candles in the bedroom. You know, there's that likelihood of falling asleep. We know that more than one-third, 36% of candle fires start in the bedroom, so it's a real area of risk. So we encourage people, don't use them in your bedroom. It's just presenting risks you just can't afford to take. And, you know, if people do fall asleep, that's just, it's just too dangerous. One thing we do encourage people to do, you know, because battery operated flameless candles do present the same feel of real candles. If you do want to have candles in your bedroom, use battery operated ones so that you can enjoy the look and feel without the risk. It's just, it's a much safer option.
And, you know, NFPA also recommends having working smoke alarms and a home escape plan. Can you just remind folks about how that can make a big difference in any emergency situation?
Yeah, so those are, that's like the two key elements of home fire safety. You need adequate detection in the event of a fire so that you can escape quickly and safely. But having a home escape plan ensures that you know how to use that time wisely if the smoke alarm sounds. So make sure you have got at least one smoke alarm on every level of the home, in each bedroom and near all sleeping areas. And then you want to have a home escape plan that typically includes two exits from every room. That's a door and a window, a path to the outside, making sure everyone knows where to meet in the event of a fire. They're basic but such important elements of home fire safety. So making sure that you have that all that in place is important for Valentine's Day, but year-round.
Year-round. And any other fire safety advice you want to share with folks to ensure they have a safe and memorable Valentine's Day?
Yeah, I think that, you know, fires can and do still happen in this country every day, but the good news is that most of them are preventable by taking simple steps. So the things we've talked about, keeping a close eye on what you're cooking, keeping a close eye on candles, making sure that they're in safe locations. These steps sound so simple, but they have such impact. So the good news is that by taking these basic precautions, you can ensure that you have a romantic holiday that goes just as you planned.
We have been talking to Susan McKelvey of the National Fire Protection Association. The NFPA is the international nonprofit organization devoted to eliminating death, injury, property, and economic loss due to fire, electrical, and related hazards. There's more information at nfpa.org. Susan, thank you so much for this reminder, and happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you. Same to you.
Okay. We'll take a break, and when we come back, science stories with Joe Johnson. He's got some news on that asteroid that's called a, quote, city killer. Yikes. That's coming up next. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we're all about salt and ghosts. New York Times cooking columnist Melissa Clark gets into everything you need to know about fancy salts. And we have a fantastic new cookbook to tell you about called Praise Song for the Kitchen Ghosts. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
This is Ira Glass. On This American Life, sometimes we just show up somewhere, turn on our tape recorders, and see what happens.
If you can't get 7 cars in 12 days, you got to look yourself in the mirror and say, holy, what, are you kidding me?
Like at this car dealership, trying to sell its monthly quota of cars, and it is not going well.
I just don't want one balloon to a car. Balloon the whole freaking place so it looks like a circus.
Real life stories every week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Our resident science guy, Joe Johnson, is back with the science stories that caught his eye recently, including ancient tattoo patterns revealed on mummies in Peru using lasers, how your ear muscles wiggle when you struggle to listen, and that asteroid that could hit Earth in December of 2032. Joe spoke with Patricio Rubio about those stories.
A new asteroid has been observed, and they think that it has a non-zero chance of hitting the Earth. Now, this was observed by the NASA ATLAS, which stands for Asteroid Terrestrial Impact Last Alert System. They love their acronyms, which is in Hurtado, Chile, in the Andes Mountains. It was discovered on December 27th of last year, and it was about 28 million miles away when they did that. It's estimated to be between 40 and 100 meters in diameter, which is 130 to 310 feet in diameter. And it's moving at about 38,000 miles per hour. So this is no slouch. Now, it's calculated right now to have a 2.2% chance of impacting the Earth on December 22nd in the year 2032. Now, NASA was quick to say that this means that there's about a 98% chance of it missing the Earth, but it is number one on the threat list.
What are some of the precautions that NASA is taking?
Right now, a lot of telescopes are tracking this asteroid to try to refine our observations and try to determine more about it. We need to know its size, we need to know its mass, and most importantly, we need to know its exact orbital path. In other words, what's its trajectory through the solar system. Now, it's currently moving away from the Earth, and it's becoming harder and harder to observe. I just saw online that the James Webb Space Telescope is going to be used to observe it. And the chance of impact in the time I've been watching this story, which is about 6 or 7 days now, has been upgraded from about 1.2% to 2.2%, so stay tuned to that. It's going to return to our near-Earth orbit, or close to us, in the year 2028. So we'll be making lots of observations to more precisely define its orbital path, its size, and ultimately figure out if it's going to hit us. Now, there's two groups studying it. NASA and the European Space Agency are both, you know, they're trying to track it, develop strategies, and figure out ways to mitigate the impact. If it is going to hit us, you know, we do have a little bit of history with this. NASA carried out what's called the DART mission, which was the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, in September 2022. They crashed a spacecraft into a small asteroid at about 13,000 miles per hour, and they were able to change its path. So there's hope there.
That's
so
crazy. We're just going to have something out of the movies.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they made a couple of movies about this. But yeah, this thing is something we're going to have to definitely watch.
Now, they're calling it, I saw one headline, they're calling it as a city-destroying asteroid.
Right.
If an asteroid of this size actually hits the Earth,
right,
what could happen?
Well, chances are 3/4 that it's going to hit somewhere in the ocean, which could mean tsunamis. It could mean a lot of vaporization of water, because all of that energy from that incoming asteroid is going to be converted into heat, and that's going to boil a lot of ocean water. So we would see probably some weather disruptions for a while. That's not real serious. But that would pass after a while. If it hit the land, you know, locally, there's going to be total devastation. This is, you know, city killer. And so the difference between 30 meters and 100 meters, though, is a big difference. So they're going to try and figure out what this thing is going to do.
Oh, that's scary. That one thing I've always heard that, you know, NASA can't track every asteroid.
Oh, sure not.
So do you think this possibility is an asteroid that could be heading towards us in a, not a near future, but hundreds of years from now that could actually hit us?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not a question of if we're going to get hit. We are going to get hit. You know, evidence, Chelyabinsk, I can't remember, that's 6 or 7 years ago now. That thing was probably about 15 or 20 meters across, exploded above the Earth and did quite a bit of damage over there.
Scary to think about, but it's amazing that we have the technology and the minds to figure all this out.
We've got a couple things going our way. Number one, it's kind of late in the game. These have been orbiting the, you know, sun for 4.5, 4.6 billion years, and so a lot of them have already been sucked up by the gravity of planets. We also have a pretty protective atmosphere, because the smaller ones just burn up. You know, you can go out and see shooting stars at night, and that's what they are. They're burning up little pieces of asteroid. And so we've got a couple things protecting us.
Is the moon's gravity enough to sort of hone in asteroids before it hits us?
Well, it would depend on the trajectory. Sure, if it went close to the moon, it could definitely change its orbital path. I mean, the moon is evidence that stuff gets hit all the time. It just doesn't have weather systems to erase it like we have on Earth. That's why there's not craters all over the Earth. There's been a lot of weather and erosion and stuff like that.
When it comes by close to Earth, would it be able to be observed by land-based telescopes, like home-based telescopes?
Well, depends on how close it is. I would think not. This thing is not really big. Mm-hmm. And so if it passes it even just a million miles away from us, you're never going to see it with an amateur telescope. NASA, however, will image it. There's actually, you can see online, the video that was used to discover it.
So let's talk about this tattoo the Peruvians discovered or created a tattoo that glows in the dark?
Yeah, well, kind of, yeah. This is from the January 13th issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This is a team of scientists were working with the mummified remains of individuals from Peru's, and I hope I say this right, the Chanque culture, which they lived on coastal Peru. Now, this is a pre-Hispanic culture known for its textile manufacturing, center of trading, very successful. It was later absorbed by the Inca Empire. Now, the mummified remains they're looking at are about 1,200 years old, and some of them were tattooed and some of them were not. So the question is, you know, is that a status thing? Was it part of your job to be tattooed? Was it, you know, what were the importance of the tattoos to them? The interesting thing is that these tattoos that they've discovered were made with an extremely fine needle. They think they used either a cactus needle or sharpened bone to push a carbon-based ink into the skin. Now, that's about one-third the diameter of most common modern tattoo needles. And so they were using very, very fine point needles. Now, previously, they've studied these using infrared technology, but they haven't been able to see a lot of detail. So they got very tricky with this. They used a technique called the laser-stimulated fluorescence, or LSF for short. That's what I'm going to refer to it as. They scanned the tattooed area with a blue laser of 405 nanometers wavelength. That's in the blue range. And the laser energy actually caused materials in the skin to glow. And the way they did it is really cool. Collagen, elastin, and tryptophan, which is an amino acid, they all have atoms that when you irradiate them with the laser, they actually absorb the laser energy and these atoms become excited. And atoms don't like to be excited. They like to be stable. So right. If they absorbed energy and got excited, they need to lose energy to return to their stable state. And they lose it as a photon of light. So the material actually gives off light. And what this does is it kind of backlit the tattoos that they previously really could not read them very well with the infrared light. Yeah. And it was really cool because there was a lot of detail that they could then see that they couldn't see with the infrared. There was one, they had like before and after photos, and there was one on a hand that looked like, it just looked like a blob. But with the laser fluorescence, it was a monkey. Mm. And so it was very cool.
How do you think something like that, like a laser-simulated fluorescence, can sort of change the way we study ancient civilizations beyond, you know, just tattoos?
Well, it'll depend on if they find something that's going to that it could be useful for to make something glow. The whole idea is that it made connective tissue and an amino acid in flesh glow. Mm. So perhaps it could be used some other way.
What do you think that the designs of the tattoos sort of reveal of the culture and sort of the artistic abilities of the ancient civilizations?
Well, the couple things struck me as I was reading the original article. First of all, the tattoos that they were showing on people were far more intricate than any of the artwork that they produced. Mm-hmm. Pottery and textiles and stuff like that were all simpler, but the tattoos that they put on people's bodies were much more complex. The other thing I thought was really, really interesting is the repetitive geometric nature of some of them. There's one photo, the arm, it looks like an arm, has been tattooed with thousands of little triangles, and they almost look like fish scales. Mm. And so just the art, level of artistry is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you could automatically assume that they were sort of mimicking what they see in life with right. the fish scales.
Which leads us to wonder, you know, why did this particular person have this particular tattoo? Is it status? Is it occupation? Why did they have them? I think that's pretty cool.
So what could tell us about ear muscles and why do we have ear muscles?
Well, let me ask you a question. Can you wiggle your ears?
I tried. I thought I was, but you said I wasn't.
Well, I can. And my dad could, too. And as far as I know, all the men in my family can. It's been estimated, and they say that it's genetic, that you do inherit it. But it's been estimated that only about 10 to 20% of people can wiggle their ears. And if you can, you can use what are called your auricular muscles. These are vestigial muscles that connect your skull and your scalp to the pinna. The pinna is the outside, the shell of your ear, the external part of your ear. Now, in our ancestors, these muscles were used to change the shape of the ear, helping to hear, you know, faint or distant sounds. And we think that they lost it about 25 million years ago. That was stated in the original article, too. But I'm not sure if they figured that out from studying skulls or how they figured that out. It's kind of like cupping your ear to hear sounds from far away. You know, it reflects the sounds back to your ear. If you watch a dog and watch a deer and stuff like that, they'll change the shape and direction of their ears to hear something. And, you know, these aren't the only vestigial structures we have, by the way. You have your tailbone, your appendix, wisdom teeth. Some people even say hair is in a vestigial structure in humans. This was an article in the Frontiers of Neuroscience Journal. A team of German scientists recruited 20 subjects, and they connected electrodes to the auricular muscles to monitor activity. When a muscle fires, it actually produces an electrical current, and that can be, you know, studied. That can be detected and studied. The test chamber that they put them in had a speaker in front and one behind. And what they did was they played an audio book to the people. And they told them, this is what you need to focus on. You're going to be tested on this later. And so please pay attention to the audiobook. And then what they did was they played podcasts and different sounds, different pitch, different volume, different speakers, in order to make it harder for them to hear the audiobook that they were concentrating on. And they had three modes. They called them easy, medium, and hard. Now, on easy and medium, they did not see a lot of activity in the muscles. But when it got to the hard, where they had to make what's called effortful listening, the superior auricular muscle above the ear was firing like crazy. And so this muscle was still trying to do what it was designed to do, what it was, you know, formerly did in our ancestors.
So it's almost like squinting for the eyes. If someone can't see something, they automatically sort of squint a little bit to try to see something mm-hmm. better. Mm-hmm.
It's an adaptation yeah. you're trying to make sure. Absolutely. And in this case, though, they were like trying to, if you watch a deer or watch a dog, their ears are always moving.
Yeah.
And our ancestors apparently had that ability too.
That's amazing. So what does it exactly mean for scientists studying this?
You know, this is one of those stories I call pure science. This is going to have an application down the line. This is a little piece of a puzzle that somebody will use to prove something someday or add to something or build something. And, you know, not all science has a particular objective in mind. You look at the space program. You know, the space program costs billions of dollars, but if you look at the technology that came out of it, that's why we're talking on this computer yeah. today. That's why we're using these computers today, partially because of the miniaturization that had to be done in order to make the space program work.
Yeah, GPS all came out of that.
Even Velcro.
In Velcro. Joe, thank you so much.
Yeah, yes. My pleasure.
Thanks to Joe and Patricio for that. We'll take a break, and when we come back, a classical music salon in Narrowsburg. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi is next. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Ira Flatow. When did you first get captivated by science? Astronaut Leland Melvin says his interest was sparked literally when his mother gave him a chemistry set.
You know, I created this explosion. I burned her carpet. She ran in the room and, you know, I got a spanking, but my brain was activated to science.
Activate your brain to science on Science Friday on Radio Catskill. Friday, 2 to 4 p.m.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This Saturday, the home of Sally Poblet in Narrowsburg, New York, will be transformed into a haven for music lovers with a classical music salon. This classical salon series is a new cultural initiative aimed at bringing together the community for evenings of intimate classical music performances and food and drink. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to Sally Poblet and musician and composer Jason Sherwin about the unique local event.
Good morning, Jason and Sally, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Thank you.
Jason,
thank you.
It's nice to see you again. You're involved in yet another project, and that is the Classical Music Night coming up on Saturday, February 15th at 4 p.m. in Narrowsburg, and you can get more information if you go to Instagram at Stonehaven on the Delaware. So, Jason, I'll start with you. Tell us a little bit about this event and its history and what's going to happen on the 15th.
Okay. Yeah. Well, on the 15th, we're going to have the second installment of a concert series that we've started there. It kind of dropped out of the sky to me over the summer. I got an email out of the blue asking if I, as a pianist, could play some Strauss or Brahms Lieder, which, I mean, was kind of like a lightning bolt because, I mean, in the area where we live in Beach Lake, I didn't know that anybody knows Strauss or Brahms or their Lieder. So it was really exciting to get that kind of invitation. And it was accompanying, we'll introduce in a second, Sally's daughter, Ava, and another singer, Yuli, who is married to a cellist, Wes, all of whom played with me on this program. And so in this concert on the 15th, Julian West will return. Unfortunately, Ava's still at school right now, so she's preparing for a senior recital, but we're hoping to have her back for the summer. And we're going to do a selection of some more Lieder. Since we are close to Valentine's Day, we will have a few nods to, you know, love.
Well, of course.
Like, why not, right?
Yes.
And but we'll also have one of the Beethoven cello sonata movements. That'll be a fun piece to play. It's been a dream of mine to play that one. I love playing that one. And then I'll also play a couple of my own piano compositions on this program. One is kind of a nod to Valentine's Day as well. It was a piece that I wrote for a family friend's wedding way back when. And then the other piece is a set of variations on a it's a Spanish dance called La Folia, or like the crazy. The craziness is kind of the translation of it, but it's like the craziness over being in love.
I love it.
Yes. So so I figured those could be make a nice round out program, you know, something fun. And it's a beautiful setting at Sally's home in Stonehaven there. And so wonderful instrument to play. And it really makes a nice vibe doing it in the living room kind of environment. Makes the intimacy of chamber music really come through to you that way.
So, Sally, you offer your home for these wonderful evenings?
Yeah, it's also actually quite a dream come true. So my husband and I have been, you know, coming to Narrowsburg for about 20 years now. And we have a Steinway that is rarely played. And one evening, a dinner guest came to our home and said, "Hey, who plays the piano?" And I said, "Well, actually, we'd love to play the piano more, but our daughters dabble, but they don't really play it, you know, sufficiently." So he said, "Well, actually, I'm a cellist and my wife is a classical singer. And how about we find a classical pianist and let's have a concert?"
I love
it. That's how this all began. And I think from just that quick conversation over dinner, I told my daughter, who is studying classical voice in college, and she was so excited. So we went on a hunt to find a classical pianist in Sullivan County. And through just a couple of phone calls and emails, we found Jason. Mm-hmm. So, and two or three weeks later, we had our first concert. And it truly was a magical evening. You know, the sun was setting, we had conversation, we had music, we had, you know, wine, and
don't forget the wonderful food.
And
you guys
the food,
prepared.
Which my daughter also prepared. And, we just had the most, you know, magical evening that day. And, we all said, let's do it again.
And you're doing it again.
And we're doing it again. And I think that we had so much fun, that we just want to keep doing it. We invited, you know, lovely people from the community, from the Upper Delaware area and PA and New York, and we all just had a good time.
And so you're planning to do more of these?
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, there was a great, like, late summer vibe to the first one we did. And, you know, now being in the, you know, in the middle of winter, it's going to have this, you know, beautiful kind of the iced river, the snow out, you know, on the mountain's edge kind of feel to it. But at the same time, you know, thinking towards the spring, one of the pieces we'll do is, so Yuli, who's the, wife of the cellist, Wes, she brings to me all these great, pieces from classical and mostly romantic literature, art songs in German. And one of the ones that she encouraged me to consider, and I'm now a huge fan of, is a song called Mainacht. So it's May evening, May night. And it's a beautiful kind of, you know, love song, but at the same time, it looks towards the spring and it looks towards the renewal that you have as you go through the middle of winter and towards the spring. So I think there's a nice aspect of what the home allows, where we've done these, where we're doing this concert and we're, you know, hoping to do more, is it invites in the outside in a way that, you know, makes a connection between the nature that's surrounding the home and the themes of the music that we're playing, and particularly in the song.
Yeah, I think the conversation and meeting others from the community really adds so much to the evening. I think that we're all still recovering from all of the isolation and separation from COVID days, that
sure,
an opportunity to get together and enjoy music together is such a balm for you know, winter, such a balm for sort of the day-to-day grind. And it's really...
Yeah. I think the conversation piece is also a nice added
yes,
piece of it all, because, you know, it's not like going to a concert hall and, you know, you sit down and it's quiet and they turn off the lights and some people fall asleep and, you know, things like that. No, it's like you're in a living room, you're having this dialogue. Like as a performer, I really got into chamber music when I was living in New York City. I, you know, started playing in people's living rooms and stuff like that. And, you know, because of just space constraints, like you have people sitting on the floor, people sitting right next to you, and, you know, next to you on the bench. And it makes this kind of cool vibe that is more conversational than you have in a concert hall, where you're on a lower level than the performers who are up on a higher level. And, or, you know, I mean, recently I went to Carnegie Hall to see one of my old piano teachers play, and I was literally in the last row of the last balcony, and it was like, you know, a telescope to even see him down
yes,
there amidst the whole orchestra. But, you know, it's in a chamber setting, it's different in terms of you really feel like you're involved in the performance as a listener, and you're involved with the performance as a performer in a way that you're listening on an intense level to the other people in the room and to your compatriots who are playing with you in a way that's very different. And then, you know, in the breaks in between, it's a nice chance for people to converse and talk and get to know one another. And the great food that Sally has had there, it helps a lot with that. So I think it'll be a really nice evening, nice winter edition.
Warmth and comfort is yeah, what we all need.
Absolutely, right? Yes.
Well, how about giving us that information again?
So the concert will be held on February 15th at 4 o'clock. In Narrowsburg. For more information, folks can reach out to me at Stonehaven on the Delaware, which is on Instagram. And we do have a lot of folks coming to the concert already. So if by chance there's not going to be much room left for this one, we will certainly have another one, hopefully in the spring or if not summer.
I want to thank you both for offering this to our community.
Absolutely.
It is appreciated,
thank
I'm
you
sure.
Thank
you for having
us
here to talk about it.
You are welcome.
Thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi, speaking to Sally Poblet and musician and composer Jason Sherwin. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, you can sign up for the Radio Catskill weekly newsletter. Get the latest local news and culture right in your inbox every Friday. Just go to wjffradio.org to sign up. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association, sullivancatskills.com, Catskill Brewery, brewing ales, lagers, and mixed fermentation beers in a LEED Gold certified building, plus a food truck and beer garden at Exit 96 off Route 17 in Livingston Manor. CatskillBrewery.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
On the next Jazz Night in America, we introduce you to Isaiah J. Thompson, a rising star of the piano, making waves in the world of jazz. That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Join me Sunday at 8 here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Today's forecast, cloudy with some snow showers developing for the afternoon, the high 27, and there's a winter weather advisory in effect from 7 p.m. tonight until 10 a.m. Thursday, bringing mixed precipitation, gusty winds, and potentially hazardous travel condition to parts of New York and Pennsylvania, including Chenango, Delaware, Otsego, and Sullivan counties in New York, and Wayne and Pike counties in Pennsylvania. The advisory extends to 1 p.m. tomorrow for Orange and Eastern Ulster counties. Expect up to 1 inch of snow and sleet accumulation, along with up to 1/10 of an inch of ice. Winds are forecast to gust as high as 40 miles an hour. The combination of icy conditions and gusty winds could lead to slippery roads and delays, especially during the Thursday morning commute. And there could be a few power outages possible due to those strong winds. Travelers are urged to slow down and exercise caution when on the roads, and updated road conditions can be obtained by calling 511 for the state that you're traveling in. Tomorrow morning, some of icing possible, as we said, and then tomorrow's high 38, winds shifting down to about 15 to 25 miles an hour. And then we're looking at another potential storm for Saturday.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new releases, film festivals, nostalgic screenings, live music events, and more. Information and schedule at the Calicoon.